Hey, I'm James Robbins, and welcome to episode 2 of Slightly Off Course. And if you missed the first episode, you're going to want to go back and listen to that first, as today will make a lot more sense. But have you ever felt that whenever you were struck with a great ambition, some big goal, and set out in pursuit, that you inevitably encountered resistance, and maybe at times your passion waned, and you eventually walked away? Well, if you've ever done that, you're not alone. And today, I sit down with Dr. James Hollis, a brilliant Jungian psychoanalyst who is going to share with us why we all live in what he calls haunted houses, and why the subconscious forces within us have a larger impact on our behavior than we give them credit for. He's also going to share some insight on how to reclaim your life and step into a more authentic version of you. So, Dr. Hollis, in your book titled Hauntings, you mentioned that each one of us lives in a haunted house, which I thought was just fascinating imagery. But what do you mean by this?
Well, we all live in the presence of our history, some of which is conscious and much of which is not conscious. And of course, how is it possible to even talk about what is not conscious? And yet, what is not present to us as an immediate understanding of something can play a huge role. And this is why we often get caught in patterns, or often get caught, you know, in self-defeating behaviors. And the way I like to put it is, none of us rises in the morning, looks in the mirror while we're brushing our teeth and saying, well, you know, today you're going to do the same stupid, repetitive things you've done for decades. But chances are we will. And the reasons we do is basically track back to the fact that we are haunted by stories. And I'm putting that word stories in quotes, if you will, that in a sense are our narrative constructions. You know, we're creatures that want our life, our experience to be meaningful. We want to understand it, and it's an inherent need, but we also want to be able to cope with it better if we understand it. So we make interpretations of what's happening. Those stories are so deeply ingrained in the floorboards we walk on that we don't know that they are, you know, fictive. You know, they're constructs. They're stories. And part of how we work as a psychoanalyst is to try to look at those patterns. Since we can't directly talk about the unconscious, we have to see how it shows up in the world through our dreams, our symptoms, that sort of thing. But we also look to patterns. You know, what are the patterns of your relationships? What are the typical places where you stub your toe? Where do you wind up being problematic to yourself or others? And to realize we don't do crazy things, we do logical things based upon what kind of story has been triggered within us. And because of this, we can sort of do a forensic examination, a reconstruction. How do we lead this back into a story? Or you know, my word story, here's another word for what Jung called a complex. Because what a complex is a charged cluster of our history. We all have them because we have history. You know, at some point, someone said to you, don't touch those irons. They hurt, you know, and sooner or later as a child, you had to touch it and find out. Well, from that moment on, you had a story, and that story was protective. And it helps you relate in a survivable way to the world around you. But many of the stories we acquire, as I was just suggesting, are often based on the child's perception of the world, which tends to get locked in and keeps getting reinforced. In other words, the more I'm in service to one of those stories, the more likely I'm to believe that they are the nature of reality. You know, when these stories are challenged, people often say, well, I've always been that way, or that's just the way I am, or that's the way people are. And those are rationalizations to legitimize a story, because we've lived through it so much and in a sense seen the world through its lens, and we've come to conclude that that's the nature of the reality of the world. And therefore, this is a long-winded way of saying, this is why I say, looking for another metaphoric approach to this problem, we all live in haunted houses and are, you know, in the presence of invisible presences, whether we know it or not.
Is this a case where we create these stories when we're young, and like you said, they're protective, and is it that they were good for us then, but we just outgrow them? They don't fit in an adult world?
Well, that's often the case. because, for example, if I learned early on as a child, you know, the best thing to do is stay out of harm's way and, you know, just avoid dealing with large situations. Well, flash forward a few decades and realize, well, if I'm going to live a life based on avoidance, how can I ever show up as myself? Or how can I be a person of value? How can I sort of fight for what is important in my life? Because, again, the more that story is served, consciously or unconsciously, the more it binds me to that past. Now, again, we all have these stories. Some are helpful and protective, and some are not. But many of them, again, are based on early perceptions and child constructions. You know, a child often thinks, well, my mother or my father doesn't like me because when they come home, they're always grouchy and, you know, they're hostile to me. And it's because I'm not worth, you know, being loved or taken care of, when it's completely ignoring the reality that person may be under huge stress at work or worried about other things. But I don't know that as a child. I just assumed, well, it's about me, you know, and it's telling me about the nature of the world. And this is what's so pernicious. As a result of the unchallenged character of that story, I can actually solicit people in my life, partners and friends, who will repeat that history, you know, who will reinforce the story, because somehow that's what I thought was the nature of reality. What Freud called the repetition compulsion. And we all have these large stories. And yes, and sometimes we outgrow them just through the natural maturation process. Sometimes life demands, you know, teach us, you know, you can ride the bicycle on your own. You can cross the street by yourself. You know, we slowly learn to take on the tasks of life. But these elemental stories tend to remain. And that's why I say one of the ways to deal with the unconscious, which otherwise would be impossible, is to say, let's look at the patterns in your life. Patterns come from deeply entrenched ghosts, if you will, hauntings, complexes. And this is my way of beginning to make them conscious and start looking for their appearance. And that's not an easy thing to do, because we've learned, you know, again, to rationalize them, to assume that they are the norm, and they have an enormous reflexive quality. They happen before you know it. So part of this work is, frankly, just limiting the damage to realize, oh, I got caught in that yesterday. I better not persist in that line of thinking or behavior. Or we might even be able to catch it in the middle of happening, in which case we can not go down the same old path again.
Yeah, and as you know, the genesis of this entire podcast came from my own discovery of just realizing, wow, I'm in this gigantic loop that I keep repeating my life year after year, but I would have never known that had I not been keeping a journal. And then I was looking at past entries and going, wait a minute, why is my life kind of on repeat? So what you're saying is this is pretty common with people.
Sure.
But again, I would not have seen that had I not actually been paying attention. So how can somebody listening to this, they might be thinking, oh, I'm not in a loop. I'm not repeating anything. How can they begin to see that, wow, maybe there are some patterns they're reliving?
Well, just to take your example for a moment, that practice of keeping a journal allowed you to step outside the flow of stimulus response for a moment and take a larger view of it. And then you begin to see, oh, I was here last year at this time. Or what happens, for example, people have similar outcomes in the dynamics of their relationships, particularly intimate relationships. And again, you have to remember, I'm the only person present in that long-running soap opera I call my life. So I've got to be somehow accountable for how this keeps turning out, both in terms of my choice of people and also the sort of dynamics that I bring to the table, the strategies of relatedness. So that's the beginning of wisdom. And so the key is, first of all, to recognize I am accountable for this, because a lot of people spend their life blaming everybody else. And they may be surrounded by troubled people. That's factual. But in the long run, we have to say, and why is it I, as an adult, continue to be enmeshed in this kind of dilemma? And realize there's something in me that pulls me toward that. And then you have to begin to say, all right, what kind of story what kind of assumption, what kind of historic encounter would have, you know, led to this that reinforces it? Where have I been here before, you know? So when we ask a basic question about why again at the meeting yesterday at the office did I just not stick in my two cents, which I felt strongly about, but I walked away just having sort of swallowed it. Why did I do that? Where does that come from in my history? And again, the problem always is there's a ready rationalization to justify your behavior at the moment or even what happened yesterday, but then go deeper and say, but listen, in the long run, that's counterproductive. Why would I undermine myself? And people do that all the time. And they do it, you know, most of us were raised to be nice children, which meant to be compliant. The alternative is not to be a bad child, so to speak. It's to be a person who is authentic in some way. And an authentic person responds out of their deepest reality, you know, with thoughtfulness toward others, of course, but out of your own truth. But most of us learn somewhere in our formation, you know, acting out of my own truth is not particularly safe. You know, it's not safe with my parent, or it's not safe with my playmates, or it's not safe in my religious or social or cultural environment. And therefore, we learn to sort of suppress ourselves. That leads to that old cliche, I'm my own worst enemy. And the enemy is not history. The enemy here is unconsciousness. And, you know, the history can be supportive or it can be harmful, but it's always present. And you can ask a pragmatic question. What is it making me do? What is it keeping me from doing? Many times people find, you know, they have an interest in life, a desire, a talent. They keep saying, well, I want to do this. I'm going to do that. And they never do it. I've had so many people say to me, I always wanted to do this. You know, there's a but in that sentence is coming up. And what is it that's keeping you from doing it? Well, there's always a rational, well, you know, we've got the children, or I can't afford it at the moment. I don't really have time for my work schedule. Yeah, right. And so what you're saying is you found a way to avoid addressing what you really are afraid to address. And why are you afraid to address it? That's the real question. What will you have to face in yourself by not addressing it? And you see, this is not easy work. You know, it's unpleasant work. It's undoing some of the protections that we acquired along life's highway, and that in itself is threatening. So this doesn't make us feel good. It actually makes us feel less comfortable, but it's out of that that any growth or change is going to ever occur.
Well, you often talk in your books about the inner life or the psyche or the soul, use different words, and that it desires to have a conversation with us. But at many times, we ignore that appointment. So what's this conversation about, and why do we avoid it?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, it's intimidating, because what if I knew what was truly right for me? Then I would have to deal with it, wouldn't I? So if I keep avoiding it, I can just slip, slide away and, you know, live an easier life. What I've come to discover, and it's not original on my part by any means, but there's something inside of each of us that knows what is right for us. Something inside knows what is right for us, but there are a thousand sentinels that say, and yet there's going to be a heavy price if you act on that. A couple of times I've had people come to me and facing large, large decisions, such as, do I continue dealing with this family situation, which will keep peace in the family, but I know it's at the price of my true love in my life or my talent or whatever, you know, and I say, you know, why have you come? And they will have some answer like, well, I was hoping to figure this out. And I said, no, not really. What you're hoping that I will do is help you ratify what you already know to be true. And Jung pointed out once, he said, most people came into the therapy at some deep level, knowing what they needed to do with their life. But, you know, were afraid of what they needed to do or intimidated by what they needed to do and or needed permission to know what they knew. So to say there's something inside that knows what's right for us, how do we know? Well, first of all, we have a feeling function, and we don't choose feelings. We can choose to discard them, anesthetize them, ignore them, project them onto other people. but they are qualitative analyses of how life is going from our perspective. So let's say that I'm in job A or B, and I'm doing all the right things. I'm rewarded for it, highly paid, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, there's no sense of joy in it. There's no sense of pleasure in it. You know, the psyche has made a statement, and it's saying you can do this the rest of your life, probably, but it's going to be a huge price if you do that. Secondly, we have energy systems, and we can mobilize our energy when we need to, and it's important and necessary to deal with the demands of life. But if you keep mobilizing your energy in the wrong direction, it ultimately, and we all know this, leads to boredom, and then burnout, and then depression, and self-medication, and so forth. So when you're doing what's right for you, the energy is there, it's supportive, and you have that flow feeling that has been written about. Thirdly, we have compensatory dreams. Dreams are about, on an average, 6 times per night we dream, and most people think, well, I don't dream, or I don't remember them, but trust me, we do. And when people start paying attention, they start remembering dreams. And the dreams themselves are a commentary on how their life is going as seen by the psyche. And then the fourth task is the most sort of elusive of all, but it's the most important of all, and that is this issue of meaning. We're meaning-seeking, meaning-creating individuals. And if what you're doing is meaningful, you can put up with the stress. You can deal with the commitment and even the suffering of it because it's meaningful to you. Life is not about happiness. Happiness is transient. Happiness is contextual. Change the moment in its unhappiness. And the question then is, what provides meaning? That's what sustains us. And you have to choose meaning over happiness at times. And when you're in right relationship to your own psychological reality, you'll be flooded with happiness from time to time, you know, along with the other human emotions.
Yeah, you know, when I think about my own life and I think of other people that I've worked with, you know, we all crave meaning. At the same time, when we get into a vocation that maybe we're not finding meaning or we're bored and we want to seek something different, there's that other powerful force of fear that holds us back. It's almost like we trade safety over meaning.
Absolutely. Most people do every day. And I understand that. We all do some days. But in the end, you know, you can't avoid the fearful things in life. But it's something else to say, I'm going to live a fearful life. You see, a fearful life is one that's governed by another force rather than the promptings of your own soul. You can't avoid fear. Only a psychotic person would have no fear. There's much to fear in life, but is fear going to dominate your life, dictate your choices? And, you know, at some point, I remember when I was struggling with whether or not to potentially leave my original profession in academia and go train in Zurich at midlife, and there was enormous risk from family risk and financial risk and every kind of risk you can imagine, and most of all, a psychological leap from something into the complete unknown. I remember asking myself, what would it take to make this happen? And so to speak, a voice came back to me very clearly and said, well, you buy a plane ticket, stupid. You know? And I thought, yeah, you buy a plane ticket. And so I did, and then there we were, living in a foreign country. I was terrified, you know? I didn't know if I was going to be able to survive over there. I'd cut myself off from my work. And, you know, I found a way. And I never looked back. I don't diminish at all the power of fear at that time, but everyone at some point in their life has an appointment with themselves. And the truth is, most people don't show up for the appointment.
Yeah, and I noticed one of my favorite lines in one of your books, actually Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life. You said that anxiety is the price of the ticket to life.
Yes. No, it's part of life. Look, life is difficult, then you die. Have a nice day, you know? I mean, there's existential anxiety. The question always is, what does it make you do? What does it keep you from doing? And there's nothing wrong with meditation. There's nothing wrong with, you know, having places that you can go to that feel reassuring and help one stabilize. That's for sure. But, you know, you don't rid yourself of anxiety. And if you do, it's at the price of something else that's valuable. Because anxiety is, in a sense, the price of the ticket for having a journey that means something. And if I choose security over that all the time, it'll be a diminished life. You won't have stretched yourself. You won't have found talents or interests or enthusiasms you didn't know you had until, you know, you stretched and they rose to support you. And another factor in this is to convert anxiety into fears. You say, well, that's no great improvement. But anxiety is free-floating. It's like fog on a highway. It can block your forward progress, but you put your hand out, there's nothing but mist in your hands. But if you stop and think, what are my fears? What are my fears, specific fears? If I do this, someone's not going to like me. When I was a child, that would have been devastating. Now that as an adult, it might be unpleasant, but is that going to stop me from moving forward with my life? Or I might find that it's more difficult than I thought. Okay, so you find out, and you learn, and you grow. You know, the fears in most cases are not going to happen. Because the child is terrified of abandonment or being overwhelmed and abused by others, and he or she will make all kinds of adaptations and security measures. But when we think about it later, that's completely ignoring the adult that we've become. And it ignores the fact that a competent adult is on the scene to help you. And that competent adult is also known as you. You know, the adult can manage the stresses and distresses that are overwhelming to the child. But again, they get locked into those primal stories. And those stories, you know, shut us down. And when we're shut down, we are, again, in service to the ghosts in the house.
So part of it is recognizing that we have some of these stories. And then is another part of it then just beginning to question those or to reexamine those? Like, does that diminish them, their power a bit?
Well, as you did with your journal, the moment you stepped outside of your story, you began to see it for what it was. Oh, this is a pattern. I did this last year. And, you know, it's hard to step out of ourselves and take a larger view, a vertical view. And that's sort of what we do in therapy. We try to step out of the horizontal plane of our life and stop and you know, look at it from another angle and say, what are the patterns of my life at work or at home and so forth? And then to realize, again, the pragmatic effect of this. This is not something that's idealistic. This is something very pragmatic because this is running your life. This is running the show. This is eating your daily lunch, you know. And these behaviors, and when I use the word story, it's really another word for complex. When people hear complex, they think of something awfully pathological. Well, again, the word complex is a neutral word. What it means is simply a cluster of our history. It has a certain energy. And when it's triggered, for whatever reason, outer or inner, that energy has the power to come up, usurp ego consciousness, temporarily take over, and make us do things, or keep us from doing things. And then it recedes into the unconscious. And so one has been in a state of psychic possession, so to speak. You know, when our ancestors talked about people suffering spells or being, you know, enchanted by someone, they recognized this. They didn't use the same kind of metaphors to describe that. So when we're in a complex, we're in an altered state of reality. And that's why sometimes you recognize, why did I get so upset yesterday? Or why do I agree to do that without even thinking it through? Things like that, where we're very chagrined at our behavior. Well, it's because, you know, the old story, the old complex was triggered. It rose up, imposed its pattern on us, and we reinforced it. Well, now you know something, you know? You learn the hard way, but yeah, I have to be mindful. When I'm in a situation like that, I have to be all the more mindful that, you know, I have a tendency, for example, to be compliant, let's say, or I have a tendency to distract or whatever. And when I know that, it doesn't mean it stops. It means at least I have a shot at, you know, not having that take over my life. You know, there's a certain automatic protective system we all develop. And that's protective, and yet sometimes the old protections keep us from stepping into a larger life. And that's why, as you were suggesting before, we often will choose security over risk. And sometimes that's the bad way to bet, because that keeps one to a smaller life.
I'm going to read you a quote from your own book. This was Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life. And this is my favorite quote of all your quotes, you have so many. And you said, "As scary as living can be, stop and think how you will feel if, on your deathbed, you look back on your life and conclude that you never really showed up because you were afraid. Isn't that grim prospect more frightening than facing the fear itself up front now?"
Mm-hmm.
And I love that quote, because it zooms out so you can see your life more in its entirety. And I don't think anyone wants to get there. No one wants to get to the end of their life and think, "Oh, like, I just didn't show up." And yet, day after day after day, a lot of times we don't show up. Again, just back to these fears and these patterns.
No, that's true. And it is another example to pull out of the horizontal and get the vertical approach to your own life. You know, zoom ahead and say, what was this life about? Was it a diminished life? I mean, none of us avoids getting hurt by life at times. And there are people we care for and so forth. It's a familiar story. But then you have to ask the question, what is my life about? What has it been about? And did I live it in a way that was honest, in a way that was authentic, in a way that was serving something larger than just the old stories that I had or the stories that were part of my culture? Did I show up? Not show off, but did I just show up as a human being here? And if the question is no, it's going to be a very sad meeting if one is conscious in those last hours. And how is that ever going to change unless one asks that question and say, all right, in what ways do I need to show up today in my life? That's the pragmatic question. I live in a 4-story condo building in Washington, D.C., and I go down 6 stories into the underground garage to get my car every morning as I head off to work. And I say to myself a 6-word motto, shut up, suit up, show up. Shut up means, you know, don't complain, don't whine. I mean, you don't have real problems. A lot of people tonight have no place to sleep and have no home. Their children are being murdered. They have no food. You have no problems. You have just life's normal stuff, okay? So shut up. That's me I'm talking to, you know. Secondly, I say, suit up, prepare, do your homework. Work hard at whatever life calls you to. And thirdly, just do your best. Throw yourself into it. Show up as best you can. That's all you can do, is just do your best. And that's all it's ever asked of any of us.
I love that. It's shut up, suit up, and show up.
Yes, you're welcome to use it.
That should be a book title. You should write another book.
Yeah, that's true.
Fantastic. Right. Yes. Well, listen, I super appreciate you spending some time with us and sharing, not only here in the podcast, but I know you've helped thousands of people, not only through therapy, but also through your writings and your books. As I've mentioned to you more than once, you have touched my life with your writings, and it's really helped me take those courageous steps to face some of my ghosts and step into a larger life, which I continue to try and do every day. But you've really inspired me a lot, so I did want to say thank you.
Well, thank you, James. And again, it's an honor for me to be part of someone else's journey, so I thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot. As I reflect on what Dr. Hollis said, I'm left with two conflicting emotions. On the one hand, I feel this immense heaviness as I consider the strength of the internal forces that I'm up against if I truly want to live life on my terms. That reminds me of Sir Edmund Hillary, the first man to climb Mount Everest, when he famously said, "It's not the mountains we conquer, but ourselves." And I also think about when Dr. Hollis said that something inside each of us knows what is right for us, but there's going to be a heavy price because there are 1,000 sentinels that stand guard of the safe and the familiar. But the other emotion I feel is one of hope, actually hope and excitement. hope that I can live a more conscious and intentional life, to do the things that I want to do and have the impact I want to have. And that makes me excited. And I hope you're excited too, because the potential that lies within you, the dreams, the desires, the stirrings of your heart, these things are there for a reason. And when you're willing to take those subtle steps that are slightly off course, you can step into a larger and more authentic journey that feels in sync with your soul. So in the next episode, I'm going to introduce you to something very powerful, which you already have at your disposal, that has the power to reshape your life and your business, regardless of where they may be. So I'll see you in the next episode. And hey, if you're enjoying this podcast, please do me a favor and tell a friend or post the link on your social media. Or if you're listening on your phone right now, take a screenshot and tag us on Instagram at Slightly Off Course Podcast. Because when you share this, you're not just sharing a podcast, you could be changing someone's life. For show notes to this episode, including the full unedited interview I did with Dr. Hollis, go to jamesrobbins.com/podcast and look for episode 2. And until then, stay awesome.